I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Cyril Christo and Marie Wilkinson. Their short film, Lysander's Song, is having its New Mexico premiere as part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival this coming Sunday, the 23rd of October at 1:45 in the afternoon at the Center for Progress and Justice. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
So last time I talked to you both on the radio, you were working on the horrifying plight of elephants. You're still at it. You decided to make this film called Lysander's Song because that's the name of your son, and you're thinking about the way that children's future and the future of wildlife, and in particular elephants, are related to each other.
Absolutely. The kids take stories before they go to bed. Adults read all sorts of things, from Dumbo to Babar, Aslan. We mentioned the lion because it's also very endangered, 20 times more in Africa than the elephant. And it's part of our memory, our inheritance as a species. And you diminish the other, and something will happen to our soul.
And I think it's such an important part of this whole conversation about ecosystems is that it's not just about healthy ecosystems, which it is. It's about our soul, as you say. It's about culture. It's about these animals having their own right to live.
Well, we so often hear about how an ecosystem is challenged by human impact or climate change or a one-off natural event. But we don't connect these places to ourselves, to our story.
We're not only interested in the ecological impact of how other species relate to humans. We have many wonderful stories of the indigenous relationship to the elephant, and we'll continue with the lion in our next book. The stories that impact us in terms of ethnically or ecologically place-based people whose identity is determined by the land, the rainfall, the matrix on which we live, but also the things that make us human. And the things that make us human are things that are not necessarily tangible. And I think that's one of the things that is key. We have a lot of scientists in this part of the world, the Santa Fe Institute, people looking at mineral depletion and what makes ecological systems relate to one another. I think what, as a poet, and Marie, who is an architect originally, we were looking at the poetics of things that are almost intangible, which are stories that relate our human presence to the other. The story of why it's important to hear a woman who is about to give birth, how she was helped by, I think, a bull elephant. Because it was a single elephant.
These are amazing
stories. These are things you can't calibrate. There's no value. There's no number attached to these. These are things that really make us human, because the story, you hear it in the Cave of Forgotten Dreams with Herzog. You see those beautiful paintings in southern France of the lions and the predators and the aurochs in which we used to live. They're still part of us. They haven't left us. But we don't want the elephant to go the way of the bison, to be corralled in a little area in southern Kenya with people surrounding them with machine guns, because that's a horrible scenario for our freedom, which is also something we mention.
Right. These stories, and it's not that if you get in the way of an elephant, it's going to lean over and give you kisses with its trunk, but there are these stories, and because they're big and dangerous creatures, but there really are these stories of elephants helping people, protecting children and things like that. They're stunning. They're true. Did you verify them? I mean, it seems like they were true stories looking at your movie.
Well, the verification came through hearing it from multiple sources when the story is only about 3 years old. But there's a combination of stories, real life happenings, real life occurrences, as well as the mythic story, which ties people to place. And one of the things that we're trying to elicit in all of us is a sense that while story may be myth, it is important in helping us understand how to live on this earth and how to live with one another and how to live with the world at large.
Cynthia Moss, who is one of the main elephant researchers in all of Africa, in southern Kenya now for over 35 years, was stroked by an elephant, a mother, after she was given water. That's in the long documentary on Cynthia Moss. We saw Double Rainbow. We had written an email to Cynthia to try to ask her about the process of mourning, which is very interesting. And within a day, of this double rainbow appearing, after we had sent her an email asking her about death and the elephant experience, supposedly her long-lasting friend, the elephant
Echo
had died within 24 hours. Amazing synchronicity.
Yeah. You have, I guess, inspired a major article in Vanity Fair, which came out a couple of months ago, about elephants. It's a huge battle between, on the one hand, people who want to conserve wildlife and elephants in particular for the many reasons you've been talking about, and on the other hand, this huge Asian market for ivory and for basically the different parts of animals, which is very hard to stem. How's it going?
It is very hard to stem. There are multiple things going on. There is an increase in the middle class in China in particular and in Asia in general. And with that increase of disposable cash or disposable income is a desire to accumulate objects, particularly ivory. And there is a problem in that I think the newest survey of the Chinese came to the conclusion that 72% of the Chinese believe that the ivory that is made into these beautiful carvings comes from ivory that's fallen off an elephant and is picked up off the ground.
Uh-huh.
And that if an elephant loses its tusks, they grow back. So they generally don't know that there is a slaughter going on. The other thing that's facilitating the slaughter is the fact that the Chinese are building much of the infrastructure throughout East Africa, well, throughout the African continent. So there are a lot of laborers there, and they're, of course, not paid well, and the Africans aren't necessarily paid well. And as we have this global economic crisis, people are trying to find multiple ways of making money, and slaughtering an elephant and selling it for its ivory is one source of income.
The Vanity Fair article has been translated into Mandarin. We're trying to figure out how to get it to higher-ups who could put maybe the non-human on the political or the human rights agenda, because it is a right for the children of the future to have this extraordinary, irreplaceable part of the planet. The Chinese are also looking for tigers. There was only 3,000, not between 400 and 350,000, hopefully more elephants, but the number's gone down since the first slaughter of over a million in the 1980s. And then the tiger is first in line for the big predators that could vanish, and the lion is also being affected with the trophy hunters.
Mm. And the lion is also being hunted because lion is also being affected because their bones are being substituted for the tiger bones.
Right, right. Much more to talk about, but we don't have much time. The film is called Lysander's Song, and it is screening as part of a series. There's a couple of short films, I think, at that time. At 1:45 on Sunday, the 23rd of October, at the Center for Progress and Justice. That's at 1420 Cerrillos Road. It's about a block up from Mudu Noodles. It's all part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Cyril Christo and Marie Wilkinson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I'd like now to welcome to the program documentary photographer Tony O'Brien. His new book is called Light in the Desert, Photographs from the Monastery of Christ in the Desert. And he will be speaking on Sunday, the 23rd of October, doing a lecture and book signing at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. And that is in conjunction with a show that's going on there called Contemplative Landscape. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a book of photographs taken at this Monastery of Christ in the Desert. How did you end up there?
Well, it's probably a bit of a long story, but
that's what we're here for.
I had known of Christ in the Desert for a number of years. I used to work at the New Mexican and heard about the monastery and often thought about going up and really never made it. When I had come back, I had been in Afghanistan, and at 1989 when I came back, some people actually, the good sisters at Mount Carmel, suggested that I go up. And so I went up and I spent about 2 weeks sort of on a retreat, gathering my thoughts and whatnot. That's my first real contact with the monastery.
And now, were you Catholic? Were you?
I was brought up a Catholic. And actually, when I went to high school, I went to a Benedictine high school in Washington, D.C. So I knew of the Benedictines. Which is what they are at Christ in the Desert. And I had always been a bit fascinated with the Benedictines. They'd never fit the mold, so to speak. And I kind of liked that.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know. They're just a little different as opposed to the Jesuits or other monastic or religious organizations. To me, they're always a little quirky. And that seemed to suit me. And after that, I had been working for different magazines and going out on assignments and whatnot. And at one point, I thought it might be very interesting to do a story about monastic life, or contemplative life, let's say. And that's really what got me up there.
To do a story about contemplative life, to what extent is it required that you be in a state of contemplation yourself?
Well, in a sense, it's probably quite important. When I first went, I thought, you know, I was approaching the story. They have a guest house, so I thought if they would allow me to do it, I would stay in the guest house and then photograph as I went along. But I quickly realized that it wasn't going to work. I was too much of an outsider, and I was trying to, in a sense, capture the essence of the life. And so I spoke with the abbot, who was a prior at that time, Philip, and talked about it, and he said, well, why don't you just become a member for a while? Why don't you become part of the community for a while?
Does that mean you're kind of a lay Benedictine monk?
No. But I was allowed to enter the community and be part of the community. I had my own cell, I had my own choir seat, and I had access to the life. And that's how it started.
And what was the life like? You get up in the morning, I think, pretty early.
Yes, earlier than I was really accustomed to. You get up about 3:30 in the morning. Vigils is at 4.
That's not morning.
And the day goes on from there until about 8 o'clock at night. And the day is divided into two parts, work, and then also we'll call it lectio, where you are at prayer, you're in your room, you're in your cell, and you're reading or whatnot.
How long did you stay there?
What I would do is I would go up anywhere from a week, 2 weeks, a month, and sometimes 3 weeks, and come back here to Santa Fe. I was married at the time. We had a child, and that's what I did.
And you did that for, what, the better part of a year?
Yeah.
So how did you, I mean, I would think, even though it's broken up by coming back, obviously, and you don't have that unbroken contemplative time and getting into the rhythm of it, still I would imagine that you do get into the rhythm of it and it kind of changes your own pace after a while.
Oh, for sure. It did. I mean, it was, you have to come back in and out, which is kind of strange, but the monastery is located at the end of a 13-mile dirt road, and it's right along the Chama River Canyon. And it's one of the more beautiful river canyons in New Mexico. So for me, going up, it was interesting. When I got up above Espanola, the landscape in many ways was similar to parts of Afghanistan that I'd been in. And once on the forest road, you had time to decompress and slowly start to re-enter this world. And the same thing applied when I left. It gave me time to sort of prepare myself to entering the other world that I was part of.
The monastic life is so simple. You live in a cell, you have a desk, you warm yourself on these wood-burning stoves, you work, and it's simple work. The monasteries, as you write in the book, they're not always, but they've strived to be pretty much self-sufficient. And then you go back to what is inevitably a more complex urban life.
Yeah. I remember I used to get out of the car, put my feet on the ground and say, okay, here we go now. Off we go into another place. But my family was very supportive, and you take it with you. I mean, it's when you're involved in that way, it slowly becomes more and more a part of you and how you view things and how you go about your life. And so that was quite wonderful.
What was the actual work you did there besides photographing?
Let's see, manual labor, digging ditches, working on the road, clearing brush, cleaning, pretty much the gamut.
And then how did you make the photographs? I mean, I get the sense, both from your writing and from the pictures themselves, that it's a non-aggressive process, so you don't go out and get the pictures. It's sort of like you let them arise or let them happen.
Well, I think that kind of happened. I mean, I came out of a world, I'm a photojournalist, that's what I did, where you do grab the pictures.
Yeah.
But I do, and I had, at that time, preferred to work on long-term projects. Because, you know, as photographers, we take. And when you're involved in a long-term project, there's more of a give and take. And you almost give something back, in a sense. So when I went, I had my camera with me. The monks knew I spoke to them. If anybody was not, you know, interested or was against my being there, I gave them the opportunity to speak up. Once I was welcomed into the community, I had my camera with me, but I probably, for the first month, never took any photographs. It helped me sort of get a sense of the life there without interfering with it. And then also gave them a chance to get used to me. And then I began to photograph. And it probably was, after about 6-7 months, I really wasn't a photographer anymore. I was Tony. So even when I was photographing, it was just natural for everyone involved.
And I think so they got used to you.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, I was part of the community. And it probably that experience changed my photography. It changed how I looked at things, how I saw. But it also, I remember you could sit in your choir seat and watch things unfold, and I sort of came to the conclusion, well, if I miss that, another one will come.
Yeah.
It's okay. And just wait and watch. And invariably, it always happened.
When you say it changed how you looked at things, what do you mean?
I became, in many ways, much more aware of my surroundings, much more of the present. And the other part to it is you sit in the chapel there, and it has incredible natural light that changes throughout the day, throughout the morning, and just watching the light.
So did you go back to that kind of high-paced, fast-paced photojournalism after that?
Not really. And I think this was also, and it was sort of unbeknownst to me, a time of transition in my life.
Yeah. You write about a very close friend named Nader Ali, with whom you were in prison in Afghanistan. And he, even without being in this book visually in any way, he's a very important part of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's very important in my life. He's a part of my life, will always be a part of my life. I guess it was when I was in prison with him that we discussed a lot of things. We discussed life, we discussed this and that. But he had an amazing trust in God, his God. He was a Muslim, he was a Shiite Muslim, but an amazing faith. It really affected me. I remember one day I was sitting in a cell and I was depressed and this and that, and life was over, everything was terrible. And I remember I was sitting on this bunk. All of a sudden this sort of bald head popped up at the foot of the bed, and he looked at me and he was very concerned because he could tell I was not happy at all. And he looked at me and he said, raised his arm up and he said, "Don't you worry, Tony. God will take care of us." And I remember thinking, my God, here I am in this prison cell. But, and please don't take this wrong, but I'm kind of like the white guy. I'm the visitor. I'm probably getting more attention than he ever will in his life because people were trying
Everybody's concerned about trying to get you out
and whatnot. And he's taking care of me.
Yeah.
And he's worried about me.
What was he there for?
You were working for Life magazine, and you were captured. What was...
He was in prison because he was just an average guy, but wanted to be part of the movement trying to drive the Soviets out. And he had been caught passing information back and forth in Kabul. And so he was put in prison and was going to do a long, long time if they didn't kill him. I mean, he really didn't know what was going to happen to him.
And what happened to him?
He was actually released. And it was very strange. I had just gone back to Kabul. And Kabul was in disarray. It was in chaos. The Mujahideen had taken it. The government was down. And, of course, there was a lot of infighting for control of the city. And so I went back to cover that, but I actually really went back to see if I could find Nader Ali. And lo and behold, I did. He had just been released from prison, I think 13 days before I got to Kabul.
Oh, my goodness.
And when, that's an interesting story. When I got there, you know, I went around trying to talk to people to see if there's any way I could find my cellmate, my former cellmate. I remember going to see actually Hamid Karzai. And at that time he was foreign minister. And I went to the UNHCR and people were like, oh, what if, you know, I hope you can find him, but there's really nothing we can do. And at that time, the UNHCR was giving little bits of money to prisoners that were released because the prison fell and everybody got out. And they said, but the chances of you finding him really are pretty nil. And I remember leaving, and there was an Afghan woman at the reception. Who was the receptionist. She said, what are you doing here? And I explained to her, and she said, what's his name? And I said, well, Nader Ali, father of Muhammad Hussein. And then I left, and she said, well, if somebody comes in, I'll let you know. And I left, and a couple of days went by, and I thought, this is not going to work. It's, you know. And I was kind of sad. And then I got a phone call saying, your friend, he just came in. He was here. And I was like, well, my God, where is he? I'll be right down. Well, he left. And I thought, oh, God, how Afghan. And so I went down. She said, no, but he's coming back. He's coming back. So I went down to see her. And I said, well, did he remember me? And she looked at me and she smiled. And she said, did he remember you? When I told him there was somebody looking for you, a journalist, he couldn't figure it out. He just couldn't understand. And finally she said, it's an American. He's a photographer. He was in prison with you. And he went, oh, Tony O'Brien, 520 Gonzales Road, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87505, Father William O'Brien. And I said to him, I said, how did you remember that? And he said, well, you know, when you left, you gave me your address. But they came to the cell, they took it, and they found it. So I went to the wall, and I scratched your name in it, so I would never forget you. And we went back to the prison cell, and there it was. And I remember him saying to me that day, you know, Tony, I know you better than anyone in the world. And you know me better than anyone in the world.
Tony O'Brien is a documentary photographer. His new book is called Light in the Desert, Photographs from the Monastery of Christ in the Desert. Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you very much.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Craig Anderson. He's Executive Director of the Center for Contemporary Arts. Patrick Noble, also known as P.A. Trix. He is a salsa DJ and a DJ, all-around DJ, and Tony Perez, who is a salsa dancer, and we're here to talk about Sweet Salsa. It's a chocolate-covered event at the Center for Contemporary Arts at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center on October 22nd. That is this Saturday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So why did you choose salsa for your annual event?
We have been talking with board members about what would be the most exciting, vibrant event that we could have that would really kind of reflect Santa Fe community and pull a lot of people together and, you know, bring wonderful things like martinis and chocolate and tapas and salsa dances, dance contest, etc. Bill Siegel had done this event before with the Rape Crisis Center successfully a number of years back, and so we decided that'd be a great thing to do this year.
Let's talk for a moment about salsa. And ladies and gentlemen, you must forgive me, but this is my great weakness in life, or great passion in life, so I could not pass it up when you guys said you were going to do an event on salsa. Patrick, can you tell us a little bit about the history of salsa?
Well, given the limited time we have, I can say...
We can do a four-hour one next week, but...
Right. How long do we have? No, it was a music that developed... salsa itself, the term came out of New York City in the late 60s, mid-70s, and the genres preceding it were mainly Cuban, things like son, mambo, and there were a lot of Cuban and Puerto Rican and other nationalities of musicians living in New York City and jamming and getting together and created this music that has since gone many other places in the world and continued to develop.
I love it that, and so few people know about this, that the immigrants from Cuba and Puerto Rico brought their music to the United States, particularly New York. Their children reinterpreted it, turned into salsa, and that salsa diffused all over the world.
Right, yeah.
As it's an American, in a funny way, it's an American art form.
Yeah, it's had a big influence even in Africa.
That's right. Now, Tony, you are from Mexico. You're a salsa dancer, and you do all sorts of different styles of salsa dance.
Yes, I do. Actually, there's quite a few different styles of dancing since we're here in the States. Continue with Patrick, history of salsa dancing. You know, this is a new version or a new word for Latin music. And also, I noticed here in the state, there's an East Coast style of dancing and West Coast, and you have Miami. So you have all these different influence from the Caribbean and in Latin America. So I think what I have my experience about being here in the States is that all of those dances become Americanized by the people who brought all that culture here. For instance, I noticed when I had the privilege to be dancing with you, Marie Charlotte, back in the maybe 99, 2000, we had this Cuban Rueda style of dancing.
Right.
And, you know, we were learning from the Miami point of view.
That's right.
And then you had the Cuban style. So there's two different styles, the Miami and Cuban, but still, you know, the same.
I know. I mean, they're close, but not the same. I mean, that's what's amazing about it. The Miami style, what is it, 37 miles away, but...
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm grateful to be here and be part of this fundraiser benefit, and I think it's going to be great.
And Patrick, you are DJing, and of course, you have a wide variety of music of all the different kinds that we were talking about, Cuban, Puerto Rican, American, and so on.
Colombian, yeah.
Venezuelan, Panamanian.
It goes on and on. Yeah, and so what I'll be playing on Saturday night remains to be seen. It'll depend on the crowd that shows up and the music that they'll want to dance to. And then, of course, we've also got the live band performing.
Sabor
is going to be performing.
Yep.
And that's Cuban music.
We're delighted that Patrick has come on board with us, and we're delighted to have Tony on board with us. I mean, it seems, you know, muy auténtico. and it's also very much Santa Fe, and it's also very much CCA, because we embrace, as you know, a very wide variety of public programming. And, you know, we're having a great year. We've had some great exhibitions. I just thank our members and our supporters and ask them to come on out on Saturday night, the 22nd.
Sweet Salsa, a chocolate-covered dance contest at the... It's not at the CCA. It's at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center.
Right.
From 6 o'clock until 10 at night. It's a fundraiser. There's all sorts of good, good food from La Boca, chocolate from Northern New Mexico's finest chocolatiers.
We've also got a ballroom dance contest, Latin ballroom dance contest. Tony will be there doing some dance lessons for people that are... wanting to learn how to dance salsa.
That's right. For those of you who have not yet been initiated into the most fun activity in the whole world, with only a few possible exceptions, come on down. And Craig Anderson, Executive Director of the CCA, Tony Perez, and Patrick Noble, also known as PA Trix, thank you all so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
¿Cómo? Que yo lo que quiero es salsa. Sí, señor.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. And don't forget to tune in from 11 to 2 this morning and early afternoon, when we are live at the DeVargas Center, or come on down to the mall and see KSFR in action.
Salsa.